Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Duff Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most righteous work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord. Hey, everyone in the Discord, how are we all doing? Yeah, cool. I mean, they can't talk, but, you know, they're
doing
all just swell.
They all spoke out loud in their rooms. Yeah. We know what's happening.
And we're here. You know what we're here for? Talking about Pale.
quick reminder before we get into it. The fan art contest is live right now. Theme of Takeover. So you can talk about the Turtle Queen or Massa or who else has done? I mean, Bristow, if you want to get retro with it.
It is all like any Wild Bow works, you know. So it can be a takeover from.
That was just to be polite.
From Worm. Yeah. It can be. Or it can be a takeover Twig. From Twig, which I haven't really read, but I'm assuming when one stick insect takes over the tree that they all live in together as a colony or whatever.
That sounds right.
That sounds like that's it's what it's about, I think. No, I know what Twig's about. I'm just kidding. I just thought that would be a funny joke. And you know what? It was. So what are we... Oh, yeah, Takeover, the fan art contest. Get your entries in. It ends on April Fool's Day, right, in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Another quick like sort of housekeeping note. I'll post in the show notes for this episode. The Pale audiobook is in desperate need of narrators. A few of their key narrators have had to sort of take a step back for various reasons. And it's looking like that project is going to seriously slow down if they don't get new readers. So if you're a reader or even if just an editor who wants to help out, please do. I'll post a link with how you can do that in here. Yep. But I really enjoy that, and I just don't have time to contribute to it myself because of this podcast, so hopefully somebody else out there does.
Yes, so links in the show notes for that. And shall we get into the chapters?
Let's do it.
Gone and done it. Have they gone and done it yet? Maybe. They've gone and done a lot of things this arc.
A lot of things have been gone and done, yeah.
Yes, very true. I really thought the titular it that they had gone and done would have been when Lucy murdered Milo, but it wasn't. They're still continuing to go and do things.
Yeah, I assumed the big one was going to be the founding, like mislanding. I still find myself unsure if that's within the scope of Arc 17. Like, I feel like for about 2 weeks now, I've been like, oh, we've probably just got one or two, because you couldn't possibly do all of that in Arc 17. Now, I don't know. Yeah, like, does this have six chapters left? Like, one chapter left? I'm completely unhinged from how this arc
Maybe we're going to go to all the way to 17-17. I could see that. anyway.
Back to when you were obsessed with 13. 13 being the end.
Well, and in my defense, that was kind of... yeah, exactly. That was kind of true. Cool. So, gone and done at 1712 with Verona. Verona and Lucy reveal to Avery that they've removed the diagram that was going to catch Miss, and Avery panics a little bit, and they now have to reset that diagram up before Miss can land successfully.
Yeah, I really like how we sort of get this confirmation from Avery that Mrs. Ritchell isn't just going to be exactly 3 days, because... Like, the Kenneteers have kept kind of saying, or not just the Kenneteers, actually, Rook as well, but they kind of been like, oh, Miss had to leave now so she can get here before Master's lordship ritual starts and ends. And, like, everyone had sort of been pretending it was roughly 3 days. So I'd sort of been sitting here for a few weeks being like, I didn't really realize that we knew it was exactly 3 days, but everyone's acting like it is. So, like, you know, I trust Verona and Rook to know what's happening with this better than I do. So I was just, like, kind of trusting the experts. And I really like that, Avery comes in and is like, it doesn't have to be exactly 3 days. And I was like, oh, cool. Okay, good. I was wondering why that was a rule we'd all just assumed was a thing.
They had fallen into the trap of, you know, the rule of narrative coherence or like narrative, connectivity, right? Because we're in the other verse, they assumed, oh, yeah, you know, things just kind of naturally work out like that. And everybody's like, oh, not for this one.
I mean, it does seem like it's pretty close. Like, they've given themselves, like...
Yeah, true.
Just, like, a 4-hour window either side or something. So it's not like it is kind of 3 days, but I just thought it was funny that like Avery was really the only one who was like, it might not be exactly three though. And I love that moment where she's like, okay, we might have miscommunicated, which was like such a diplomatic way to say you guys have fucked this up.
Yeah. I'm just going to quickly look over at my wall calendar here. Oh, yeah. It says it's been about a million chapters since Charles has done anything. So it's interesting. Charles still just biding his time, waiting for that chance to strike. He's patient. We knew this was happening during summer break. Like we talked about this right after. But like Charles is such a fuck. He's such a piece of shit.
I just have to, it's all part of his plan. I have to believe he's got a plan that relies on striking right at the last second. Because that feels very Marissa-y too, but
I think Charles thinks he has a plan. And maybe like he has a plan, but it's not like a plan that will actually deal with anything. And part of the plan is make sure the Kennedys actually do all the work. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I'd love it if making Kennet found actually kind of fucked with his plan.
That would be fun. But yeah, so we're getting into true chaos mode now, right? Like, Matthew's domain claim is ending, and then we talk about that a bit in these chapters of like, even then Matthew's still kind of fucked. Then we have Miss landing and the founding, and then we have like a day to manage the fallout from that before Muss's lordship claim timeline expires, right? So there's a lot of stuff that the Kennedys have to worry about, and they're all like huge, huge problems. It's setting up the most chaotic Arc 18 ever, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, this is the thing. If Arc 18 doesn't get started soon, I'm like, we can't fit all of that into Arc 17. Like, you'd think. But yeah, you're right. There's just so much. Like this feels even bigger than Arc 13 already, because it's sort of like there's just. Arc 13 was really like, oh, there's like 100 things that are all going to happen in this one night or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like this one big deadline. Whereas here we've just got like, it's more chaotic because it's like a bunch that are kind of almost as epic and they're all just like in a row and we kind of need all of them to fall the right way.
Yep.
Just feels like a different and more kind of intense pressure than Arc 13 in a way.
Mm.
Part of it as well. I don't think the Kennedys, like at the start of this weekend, really anticipated having to essentially be at war with 80 practitioners.
Yeah.
Like, it reminds me a bit of, back in Arc 3, we kind of used to give the Kennet others shit for not being prepared for things like the Aware or just like Alexander and stuff in general. And it kind of feels like this is what it must have looked like to them when just practitioners showed up and they're like, oh, this is much worse than we expected. Alexander brought friends. So, Muscle brought 80
friends this time, yeah. And it's interesting. There's, like, a strength to that, but there's also a weakness to it in what we see with, like, Verena bonding with Macaulay and Lucy having that moment with Scott Martin later. Like, it's not just a strength that there are 80 practitioners here, right, which is interesting. It actually, in some ways, exposes them to even more problems because of things like they're just able to get into Verona's domain, just by basically talking to the people who are supposed to be guarding it. And I think that's great. I think it's like, such a different type of threat in the sense of like Alexander had a small group of, and Bristow had his small group of aware, and they were very targeted and handpicked for this exact mission. And now Muss is just like, fuck it, get everybody. And because of who he is, there's such a vulnerability in that. And I think it's so wonderful. It's just like, it's great stuff.
No, you're right, because you don't see that going as much the other way. Like the discord in the Kennet side tends to be around how much do we want to kill these guys? like the discord is Rook going too far. Mm. Whereas Muss's side is definitely a lot more morally fractured.
But yeah, so the main problem of these two chapters is the parents. the parents are
We haven't even talked about that yet.
No, exactly.
What we're about to be talking about for a long time, but I love how we've just gone off on the list of like 30 high pressure things that have got going on. We haven't even touched on the parents.
Yeah, which is maybe one of my most favorite things here. The parents becoming aware, and you know, like obviously, we had the thing with Avery and her dad last chapter, and it's like so they're so clearly aware that something is fucked up. And Verona does an admirable job at giving just good enough answers to not make the situation worse. But even so, it's clear like they're not weaseling their way out of this one.
Yeah, I mean, I before we even get to it, I want to really touch on the argument they have beforehand about whether they even want to go talk to the parents, especially it's a Verona chapter. We need to talk about this.
Yes, because Verona, of course, just like, whatever, we can just ignore the parents and not deal with them, and we'll deal with it later. And Lucy and Avery are obviously like, we don't want to do that. We actually want to have relationships with our parents.
Yeah, there's one moment where Verona actually gets a little bit defensive and like is a bit like, well, what, you think I don't need that because I don't have a good family situation? And Lucy's a bit like, well, I mean,
well, yeah,
not entirely. But yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting argument because I think Verona really has a point that like doing this is not the like quote unquote logical play. Like it hampers them. Like the net result of this at the end of it is that like Jasmine is just keeping a tighter eye on them, which means, you know, they need to spend more power on connection blockers. Like, and it could have gone worse. So like on a level she's right, but like it's definitely coming from like her place of anti-family / anti-Kennet above bias. Like the thing that jumped into my head as I was reading this was Lucy gave Chloe that sweater. She used like some of their last glamour on fixing up Chloe's sweater. And then Lucy was like, oh, was this the right call? And Verona was pretty much instantly like, yeah, if we're not doing stuff like that, what are we fighting for? Like blah blah blah. And it was like this great moment, and it's like, where's those vibes right now, Verona? Like when it comes to like innocence and family, Verona's a bit like, oh, it's just an obstacle right now. And admittedly things are genuinely worse now, but like I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, that's the way those two cookies crumbled.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree.
And, you know, she's about to spend like 8 hours or whatever at a sleepover. So, like, if we're talking about what, you know, makes sense, you know, to do in this high pressure situation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess it's a marker of Verona's lack of self-awareness of like, she doesn't get that same value from her family relationships, obviously, but she clearly does get value from some human connections because she takes some downtime just for that exact purpose in the next this/the next chapter, right?
Yeah. Like I get, I really get what she was saying about how it just creates more problems talking to their parents, but it does baffle me a little bit that she can't see Lucy and Avery's point of like just connection blocking over this is not a good long-term strategy. Because I mean, it's especially ironic because like Verona has gotten herself into a lot of the holes she's in right now because she was dropping connection blockers on like, you know, relationships willy-nilly and using the fetch. Like there's this quote from Avery where Avery says, if we bail, if we put this all off, then I think things get poisoned a bit in the meantime. And I was just like Verona sort of disregards that advice. And I was like, no, Verona, you need to be paying attention to that because that has almost certainly happened to you a number of times.
But yeah, should we get into the chat with the parents?
Yeah, oh, it's so good.
It is good, isn't it? The thesis of my thoughts on this throughout these two chapters are I want the parents to be aware. I just narratively and from a character perspective and everything, like I just want that so much. And I know that like runs completely counter to the, you know, the trope of the, you know, the magical children and the parents who don't know about it, you know, the children who have access to a world that their parents just can never understand, etc. Like, I know that's completely counter to the whole trope that this is, you know, playing with, but at the same time, That's why it's so juicy. I just want it so badly.
I think it's like, because I'm in the same boat. I was like, I'm so ready for Connor and maybe Jasmine to be made aware sometime soon.
And I mean, like, I hate to say it, but Verona's parents, either of which becoming aware would be fucking incredible.
Oh, from a story.
For very different reasons. Yes.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Like, yeah. 100%. Brett. Well, Brett's so far gone. Sylvia coming in and being made aware would be hilarious. But yeah, I just, it really stood out to me that I wanted that because I feel like so many shitty superhero and magic stories have usually conditioned me to feel the opposite. And I hate when everyone else gets in on the secret identities and such. And I was like, it's really a testament to the way Walbo has, like, you know, sowed this soil and, like, his patience that it's come to the point, you know, because we're 2.5 million words into this story or whatever, and this is sort of the first time it's really felt real that this might happen to one of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why it's working, is this is, like, this has been built up to in such a way that it doesn't feel like it's going to cheapen things at all.
Well, yeah, I think maybe what it comes down to is in a lot of those types of stories, the not as well done ones, you know, like the mundane life is boring and something to be gotten away from so we can get to the escapism stuff, right? But obviously it's a testament to Walbo Skua that the depth of relationships between, you know, Jasmine and Lucy, right? Like, they're so captivating, and I am so interested to know how the parents would react to these situations, right? Like, it's so narratively and dramatically rich.
Yeah. It's just in a way that, you know, like something like The Flash was not.
Yes, you know, exactly right. Because, yeah, that was the, it was kind of clear by the people who were creating that show that that's the part they didn't care about, and that's fine. But then, you know, they kind of felt like, oh, well, we have to do it, I guess. We've got to eventually get, you know, every single one of Barry Allen's family to have superpowers.
I guess actually to touch on like what you're talking about, a great example of that would be the moment Avery's trying to weasel out of this and she's talking about like why it's okay that she's friends with Liberty. And she reveals this like, oh, you know, and I upset Liberty because that was the weekend I started dating Nora. And then Kelsey's like, wait, you're dating Nora? And Avery's like, oh, God, help. And I was like, I love that. It's like the secrets of her personal life are kind of what starts to come out here. And that, like, I've just never seen that before. Like, usually all of the secrets have to do with the secret identity. So, like, it's just, you're absolutely right. It's like a testament to the strength of the personal lives in this story that arguably one of the biggest oh shit moments in this whole section is Avery revealing she's got a girlfriend.
Yeah. I want to respond to something in chat as well, because, you know, people are calling out, like, Clawford says Jasmine would probably draw a line. Murph Strike is thinking, how would this actually keep the trio in the story in Kennet rather than the parents just like ditching, which is so true, because I want to reinforce, like, I don't think this is a solution to their problems for sure. Like,
oh, especially not right now. Like, I don't think anybody is saying, you know what we need tonight in the middle of all these deadlines and rituals is the Kenneteers to awaken their parents. Like,
yeah. Nobody would just awaken some like random people during a crisis. It's a terrible idea. You need to make sure you consider it and do it carefully. I agree. But like, it just is so captivating. I just want it so badly.
Yeah. But I want it to wait till after these, you know, when we get Musa to piss off or whatever, and then Charles becomes the baddie again. If that's even going to happen, I don't fucking know what this story looks like after Musa's lordship claim anymore. But, like, you know, I'd want it to be saved for after the lordship claim. It's like, okay, now we've got a couple of weeks off before, you know, Musa's back, or we have to fight Charles. And then you can't, like, Jasmine walks in and it's like, I'm aware now. What up?
I wonder if the method to do that is the letters, right? Because I think we got a reference to the letters a few chapters ago, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that they're still their contingency plan. I wonder if, you know, Connor finds a letter or something and that's what tips it over the edge.
I kind of got the impression from this chapter that Connor's kind of already tipped. I suppose he could. They tipped, do hint.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
They could undo it, but Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Connor's so funny in this whole conversation because he's really the thorn in like Verona's side as she's trying to cover this up. Like the spirits keep doing them a solid and distracting from stuff. And then it's like as Jasmine gets distracted and starts talking to the nurse, Connor's just the one who's like, what about tell us more about this.
My favorite is when he just randomly says, do you know why the moon is bleeding? And and the Verona's response is she feels a shiver run down her back. And you feel like I felt that. Yeah. I was like, oh, fuck. Like, that's just such a clear fucked moment. It's so good.
Yeah, like, you know, Jasmine's really flirting with the line and starting to make connections, but in a very undoable way, whereas Connor just feels so much like he, at least right now, he's past the threshold. It's a question of whether you can put it back up while he's sleeping on meds.
Yeah. I want to pull out one more thing, which is, again, like a testament to the depth of the interpersonal drama here, is one of the most crazy parts is when Jasmine looks at Verona and says, I want to believe you wouldn't look me in the eye and manipulate me. And we and Verona immediately think, well, that's exactly what she's doing. I mean, like, yeah. And, you know, they have reasons, but really it's gotten to the point where I think they're kind of just, I almost feel like they've just fallen into the habit of manipulating their parents and they haven't, like, stopped to think about it, which is, I understand they don't have time to do that, but it's like, what a gut punch, you know? God, so good.
Yeah, there's a few of these moments with Jasmine where we get the little reminders that, like, I mean, Jazz is the closest thing Verona has to a mother figure, really.
Yeah.
And there's another moment where Jasmine kind of looks at Lucy in this really upset way that hits Verona super hard. It's so good. It's like, I want to see the conversation with Jasmine where they don't have to hold back anymore. It would be so
delightful. It would be so cathartic, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I want Jasmine to have the answers. I hate that Jasmine is so in the dark and is like, she's so good. She's doing so well. She's really trying her best. And you can see she's genuinely so lost for what to do. And she says things. There's that moment in the car where she's talking to Lucy and she's like,
did I do something wrong?
Yeah, and she talks about, like, I kind of think it might be the right move to send Verona to live with her mother and get her out of town, but I feel like you would hate me for it. And Lucy's like, no, I wouldn't hate you, because Lucy knows, like, they're putting her in this situation. Like, it's so heartbreaking. It's so crazy how, again, we're in the middle of fucking this town blowing up three different times and this interaction with their parents is like the most heartbreaking part of it right now.
Yeah, it's so fucking absolutely good. Yeah, the bit with Jasmine in the car at the end, which is where she feels the most like she's teetering on the edge of awareness.
Yeah.
And she starts to be like, should I have been stricter? Like, did I do something wrong? That was, really that moment where I was like, God, this is just hurting Jazz. Like, she's, these dots that she can't connect because she doesn't know the rules and all that is just causing her to question herself and her parenting skills, which is so unfair because meanwhile Brett's over here fucking thinks, you know, nothing's his fault. And it's like, wait, the good person is the person who's suffering through all this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it goes, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, just great. Just absolutely great stuff.
Yeah, I really hope that at some point we have to have more of a conversation with Jazz. But in the meantime, we've got Connor looks like that's much more of a certainty to happen soon.
Do you think we're going to get another, like, we need to talk about the girls style extra material? I would love it. How good would it be? Oh, God.
I want Connor to meet Snowdrop.
Snowdrop? Of all the others in town you'd pick?
Yes. Just specifically because she's Avery's familiar. I want to see him grasp at the fact that she's essentially his, like, sixth child.
Yeah, like a niece, kind of.
Yeah. Also, well, just because...
I guess it's more analogous to, like a spouse, a partner of one of your children.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like Snowdrop's closer to, like, an adopted sibling.
Yeah, sure.
In my head. I don't know, just because, like, Kelsey had that moment in this where she found out Avery had been bandaging her own wounds out in Whoop Whoop. Kelsey's like, oh my God, our daughter's a feral. Yeah. I was just like, I want Connor to find out she's also life bonded to an opossum. Like,
I just want the parents. You know what? I just want a sequel story that is Connor and Jasmine falling into the world of Kennet and like meeting Toad Swallow and, you know, all the people in town and just kind of getting to know them. You know,
imagine like Biscuit being around when one of the parents is like aware to like when they're getting the rundown, it's like, hi, you know, this is our council of monsters, like blah, blah. And you can just be like, you know, Connor saying, God, I need a drink, and Biscuit offering him one. Lucy and Avery having to be like, no, oh, no.
God, I want it so badly. I want, yeah, you know what it is? I want a series of extra materials where the Kenneteers bring their parents to meet key Kennet council members, you know, each week they meet a new council member and it's just delightful every time.
One at a time.
Yeah.
No, I can't picture a way that Connor and or Jasmine becoming aware isn't just an absolute delight from a story perspective. It could be horrible for everyone involved in the story, but not for us.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I'm sure it would be horrible and like chaotic in so many ways, but also, like, I genuinely think there would be a lot to be gained from Jasmine meeting like Miss and Rook and being able to like have a reunion with Rook following the thing that happened at summer break. Like, I feel like there's a lot of not bad, good, like emotional depth that would come from that isn't chaos and trouble, you know?
No, I agree. I just don't see how that could happen in the present circumstances.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Anywho, so yeah, they're at the hospital. The trio are gathering in the hallway, kind of reeling a bit and starting to plan their next moves with the diagram and kind of figuring stuff out.
Yeah, and I love this moment where, like, we sort of talked about this last week, Verona kind of acts as our audience surrogate and is just absolutely horrified that Avery and Lucy casually move on from, like, the deeper cosmic truth of the Page of the Suns. Avery's like, yeah, you know, he's quizzing me about, like, cosmic truths and, you know, the cogs of the universe, but, like, we need to get back to talking about Kennet. We talked last week about how usually protagonists doing that is a pet peeve of mine, but I felt it for Avery, but I also loved seeing Verona get to be that insert that I normally want with the character who's like, I'm sorry, why aren't we talking about this dope lore drop?
Like, how are we moving on from this? For sure.
It was just a fun follow-up to Avery's very justified casualness with it last week. I loved it.
Yeah, no, it was definitely, it was good stuff for sure. Loved it. there's so much going on. How can you deal with it all? I'm glad they're pulling Zed back into the story. It's a good idea bringing Zed in to do some quick diagramming. We know that that's something that Technomancy is good at. So kind of makes a lot of sense. It tracks. It's good stuff.
Yeah, and he's just fun. I mean, I guess we'll get to it when he actually shows off next chapter, but like, yeah, he's also just so much fun to have around.
Yeah. He is a delightful character. We're going to get some more Zed. That's good. So then as they're at the hospital, Macaulay Henniger and some other folks head into the hospital to cause trouble. They basically are just here to fuck with the Kenneteers and throw as much trouble and distractions their way as possible.
Yep. And I feel like this moment really hammers home like what we've been talking about so much already, which is just how overwhelmed Kennet is right now. Like, they don't even have more than 15 minutes with their parents in the hospital before they're just getting attacked in an innocent place like this by like a blackguard and stuff. Like, how the Kenneteers aren't melting down even more than they are is just beyond me.
Yeah. They really can't catch a break, can they? Like, intentionally, it seems like Musa's strategy is not let them have a break.
Yeah, which makes sense. They've employed the same strategy on enemies.
It's basically the same thing they're doing against Musa, or were doing against Musa and his folks when they were, you know, denying them good sleep and kicking them out of their hotel and stuff. So payback. Payback's turnabout is fair play. I love this moment where Verona grabs her bag and is about to get out the big red button that will nuke all the technology in the area. And Lucy and the audience both immediately have to remind her, no, there's major collateral damage that will happen if you do that because we're in a hospital. And Verona just kind of didn't think of that. A classic Verona thing to overlook.
It's funny you say that. It took me, after Lucy said it, like still a few seconds for it to click. Like,
oh, yeah.
Verona started to pull out the big red button. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then Lucy's like, Ronnie, we're in a hospital. And I was like, why does that? Oh, okay. No, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Verona, a classic Verona moment.
I love how she weaponizes her healing potion here too. Like, just speaking of the way she uses tools, like she has a healing potion. So this guy like injures himself, so she just like throws healing potion at him
in exchange. Yeah, it becomes this weird reverse fight where he's trying to injure himself and she's trying to heal him. Fucking ridiculous. But yeah, so Macaulay helps him get out of this bind, luckily, because it seems like it's gonna ensnare them for a bit there. And then the parents take the girls home, Verona going with Jasmine and Lucy, and this is that car scene that we were referring to earlier.
Yeah, and it's just worth pointing out, like, it's a really good thing Macaulay was actually on their side, because her half-ass scheme here totally worked on them, and they were kind of completely fucked. Yep. Until she then came back and saved them from the predicament she put them in.
Yeah, it was very much, they had been pretty thoroughly ensnared by it until
she bailed them out. They got played so easily. Like, yeah. Yeah. I just love that. Like, that, you know, Macaulay really saves their ass here from herself, admittedly, but, you know, she needs to maintain her cover.
Mm. Yeah. Great work, Macaulay. And yeah, I mean, to jump back to this car conversation, like, aware parents, I want it. I love it. I need it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm finding myself sitting here. I don't know how many other people feel like this. I genuinely have no idea if, like, the end of Musa's lordship claim is the end of the story, or whether there's, like, still another three arcs after that. You know what I mean? Like, what does the story, what does Kennet, what do our characters look like 3 days from now in the story? I have absolutely, like, it could go either way. I have no idea what to prepare for. And I feel like the way we were tricked with summer break is contributing to that in a big way. And I just love that the story's done this to me. I'm now just completely unsure what the outcome will be, what it looks like afterwards, either way. It's such a great state to be in. Like Wolford's bringing up Charles, and I have to deal with Charles at some point. Like, I fully agree, but like, I feel like Charles is going to come up during Musa's lordship ritual, right? Like, you know, there's a strong possibility of that. So this could be this big climactic thing where it all comes in together for this scene, or this, you know, lordship contest here, or maybe it doesn't. I don't fucking know. Like, maybe this is it, and then the aware parents is like epilogue material. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. There's just so much going on. It's impossible to predict, right?
And I don't quite know what our end game is, where we're going. Because, like, if you remember, we spent a huge chunk of arcs 14 and 15 being like, we're going to take down Charles. We need to kill Charles. I mean, at this point, they're closer to working with him, because I don't think we realized how big a threat Musa was at the time. But, like, you know, Charles has already lost 80% of his domain pretty permanently. So is he as big a threat now as he used to be? Like, do we just let him live in squalor over his, like, shit small area? I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, yeah. I
don't know what the end of this story is meant to look like, and I just love that. Like, summer break felt so clear. We had, for most of this story, we had this clear sort of, you know, this Carmine contest will happen and that will sort of end things. And there's nothing like that now. There's like, oh, we'll probably beat Charles and maybe Musa.
Yeah. I mean, it must be. But Charles is the real unknown, right? Because we just don't know what the fuck he's going to do.
No, I still assume he's going to come in with some scheme he's been holding on to for a long time. But, like, I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows?
I know we'd already touched on this, but I do just want to say, like, in this car ride here, Jasmine really just knocks it out of the park in terms of, like, as she's starting to teeter on this edge of awareness, she basically is like, just checking with the Kenneteers whether she was still a good mom. Like, was I still, did I make a mistake punishing you like this or letting you off of that? And she's like, don't worry, Verona, I won't tell Brett stuff because I've been reading books and I see how that was ammunition for him to use against you. Like, which is just, you know, she's been using some of her spare time to do reading to better support Verona. Like, what a fucking champ. And I hate that she's questioning herself like this because of the lies they're having to tell her.
Yeah, no, she's so good. And that's, I think, what is the most heartbreaking about it is that the Kenneteers can't reaffirm to her, like, this is just bigger than you, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So, yeah, Verona reaches home and her dad is there. And in contrast to the parents who have been parenting, he does not. Macaulay appears at her house and tells her that something's up with Edith.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need to talk about Brett. Like, he's just doubling down on all his same bullshit as ever, really. Like, just continuing to be the worst.
Yeah. what a jerk. Yeah, it's just Brett. I do love this bit where Verona and Macaulay bond. Like, we'll get to it more next chapter, but they do have a real shared experience there. So thumbs up. Oh, sounds like they're a good team.
Yeah, it's so good. That moment where, like, because we've seen Verona for the last few chapters be a bit like, well, you know, Macaulay gets it, man. Like, you know, she doesn't give a shit about anything and that's so cool and I'm kind of jealous. And the last few chapters have really been Verona looking up to Macaulay and thinking she's cool more and more. And it's so great seeing this moment go the other way where Macaulay just, she gets like 5 seconds of looking at Brett and she's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Verona gets it too. And like that instant moment of connection when you see it click for Macaulay just is so satisfying for you as a reader. Cause you're like, oh, thank God. Here's somebody who can kind of understand Verona a bit better now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hey, Verona, did you notice that happened because she saw Brett? Like, you know, these sorts of opening up like this and communicating can help. Like, you know, Macaulay might not have said yes to this sleepover if she hadn't seen your dad, didn't know about this.
Yeah, it's it's a good point. Maybe a more opening up will help Verona have human connections. So getting to this Edith thing, Edith is not angry, she's sad. And Verona surmises that Rook has made a deal with Edith, which is very accurate, very, very cleverly accurate by Verona. But yeah, to put herself on the line in order to strengthen Matthew's doom. And I think we'll get to this next chapter, but holy shit, Edith. I mean, Rook.
Yeah, exactly. We'll save most of the judgment of Rook till we get to the meeting next chapter, I suppose. But I do think it's really cool that we get this right after seeing Brett again, because obviously, like, the Brett-Edith comparisons have been, like, very textual. And I just think it hits us as readers a lot harder that Rook has betrayed us like this because we just saw Brett again and got reminded how much we hate Brett. So it's like, you know, you go from Brett to the other Brett and then we find out Rook has cut a deal with her and you're just like, oh, fuck that then. Like, fuck Rook right now.
Yeah. yeah. God. What a chapter, huh?
I'd put this up as a candidate for best chapter in the story. There's obviously recency bias there, but like, this would be up there, I reckon.
Yeah. It's all the stuff with the parents was just so strong. Yeah.
And I think us seeing that through Verona's perspective was such like a genius move. Because I think, like you know, the obvious thing to do would be to have us see this thing with, like, Connor and Jasmine from, you know, maybe Avery's, possibly Lucy's perspective. Like, the extra layer of, content Wobbo was able to milk out of it, being Verona, who's the one who's not quite on board with this and a bit detached from the parents, it was just such a clever idea. And we got to get Verona's journey as well as, like, through her watching the other two understand what was happening to them as well. Like, it's... So clever.
Yeah. Yeah. A great chapter. So next up, 17.13, we're with Lucy. Lucy is kind of auditing the practitioners who've come into Kennet while looking over some of the Undercity folks who are scrapping. Just a good, solid scrap.
This opening is so fucking cool. Like, it's like each paragraph is alternating between, like, Lucy monologuing on the state of things. And then, like, the next one will cut to us watching this lady. We have no idea what she's about. And she's just fucking tearing into practitioners and stuck arounds and cursing them with her tongue that she's cutting open. And, like, I just love that vibe between, like, brief summary of the story, kind of, you know, for Lucy's sake in the universe, but I think also it was good for us as readers to kind of get this recap from Lucy on sort of the vibe of things right now. But interspersed within that kind of recap for our convenience is just this scene where you're sitting there scratching your head going, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, a great chaotic start, right? I feel like every chapter is going to start with some hardcore chaos just to get us back into the vibe of, like, there's a lot of stuff going on.
But what a great way to dampen the impact of, like, sometimes, like, exhaustive recaps in a story can feel, like, almost condescending. Like one example I can think of, because the Expanse books are published, they, like, and a lot of published books do this, they feel like when you start, like, book 8, it will sort of reintroduce concepts to you in case, you know, readers have forgotten from the previous book, or I guess in case somebody's starting at book 8 for some reason. It always feels just really condescending when, you know, like a book number 7 in the series will be like, you know, oh, and of course, you know, the people from blah, blah, blah are blah, 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 blah.
Mm.
You get around that feeling of condescension so easily by just also confusing the fuck out of us as you're giving us that explanation.
Yep. Good stuff. I just want to call out, we learn about these old bodies of Pietro and they're so horrifying and they're just like, there's not enough time for them to be a big deal right now.
Yeah, you're right. At other points in the story, this would have been huge news that would have had chapters dedicated to it, whereas now it's just like, oh yeah, I guess the Bitterstreet Witch has launched her 5 essentially equivalents to her in many ways, that, you know, she's been keeping in the wings and doesn't really use very often. Anyway, because we've never heard of them. It was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's very funny.
each one is just a different flavor of Bitterstreet Witch. Like, that's, there's so much to unpack there, and we don't. It's just like, okay.
Yeah. I think this was also a great...
I just want to say as well, I love... In Lucy's speech that she's giving to Sok-Nash and your boy, she does quickly mention again, like, so many of the practitioners who are here actually have, like, less experience in shit like this than the Kenneteers do. Like, I think she actually phrases it as, like, they have less experience after however many years than I got in my first 3 weeks. And I love these sorts of reminders, I guess. Like, the story does keep giving them to us, but, you know, it would be a bit unbelievable that the Kenneteers are holding their own against 80 practitioners if we didn't sort of have bits like this in the story where it's reminding us that, like,
yeah,
most of these guys are effectively operating in very safe, contained spaces for the majority of their lives, and they don't see wild shit like this. So the Kenneteers are kind of very overpowered in this sort of situation, in a way. I just really like that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, true. There's there's a lot of stuff going on that helps to even the, you know, field, I suppose.
Well, and it does make me think, like, the one thing Lucy brings up is she's like, yeah, the ones we have to worry about, the ones who are kind of on our level, are the other combat mages. So, like, the Sonjatais, the Hennigans, yes, and stuff. And I think we've already talked about this, but it just again made me think, What's Musa's plan for once he's seized all the territories with all these, like, he's made so many deals with war mages, and it's you know, this is a problem with real life revolutions as well, is when you militarize everyone up and then you get peace, what do you do with all these military people? But it's even more of a problem in this world because the Hennigers can't really switch it off. Like, they're very much Like, the Hennigers aren't going to switch to a peaceful life. They're going to need to do some kind of enforcing or something at the very least. I don't understand how you can have a peaceful and stable regime with these guys at all various levels of it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, don't know. Musa, I don't think, has really put enough thought into it.
I reckon he probably has, but his plan is just to, like, yeah, use them against dissidents or whatever the fuck.
Yes, true. great chapter for us students. There's a lot to learn from the master.
Sorry, I need to say, because people aren't going to, like, he spelt students S-T-E-W, like Stu yeah, Mullen.
Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that that's a collective name for fans of Stu Mullen.
Maybe that's just me. I'm just an idiot.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think you have something. You should maybe studio be yourself. I need to studio. Yeah. but yeah, I love this moment where it starts with, in like the second sentence, Lucius, I'm paraphrasing, and then about 25, actually I counted, it was 25 paragraphs later, Stu reveals that he hasn't been listening for this entire chapter. Stu, you're such a fucking champ. Love him.
Yeah, because he gets caught up on what a paraphrases is.
Yes, what a hero.
He's got that great himbo energy. Like, he's a big scarred dude and he wants to go fight shit, and he's just polite and nice about it, and also a big idiot.
Yeah. it's good stuff. Love him. Love Stu. Anywho, so yeah, one of these practitioners summons an angel to wall in Lucy and her crew, and it is seemingly very good at building walls.
Yeah, that's definitely. I'm very confused. Like, the story kind of acts like this thing is super powerful and unbeatable, but I was just like, oh, I mean, all it did is build walls. I mean, it was very good at building those walls, but like, it kind of felt like they could have smacked it around a bit more, and it would have been building less walls.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I'm willing to trust Lucy on this, but it was just, I just thought it was funny that this thing was just running around building walls and Lucy was like, oh shit, this is out of control.
I mean, it's weird. Like, it seems, it's obviously got a specific niche and it really just like follows the one instruction that it's given. But also, basically nothing they do seems to impact it at all. It's like on a completely different level.
I mean, I guess that's certainly the vibe Lucy gives off. Did they even really hit it at all? I mean, maybe that's the thing. Maybe they didn't hit it because it's that good. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like they definitely tried to hit some of its walls and weren't doing much. And like, I don't know. It seems like it was pretty rough for them to do much to it.
Yeah, I did really enjoy the little, like, the bits of lore about how, like, so gods don't create things and the non-recycling sense, when they want to do that, they like hire angels to do it. Like, it was like, oh, when a god is ready to create, you know, the angel is their hammer, which just makes it sound like the angels kind of exist at all times, and basically, you know, you earn enough god credit to, you know, borrow their services for a bit. Like, it's and so then how did the practitioners get one? Like, there's so many, this raises so many more questions than it does answers, which is the best kind of lore drop.
Yeah, it really is the kind of thing that feels like there's a whole story in it somewhere, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Then a familiar face shows up. It's Angie Demarest.
Yay, we all missed her so much. Yeah,
glad she's back. She's back with a vengeance, but Lucy wins with the old pair reflection special. E.g., turning Angie into a pale reflection of herself.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why we were taking credit for this. But, sorry, you've skipped over the best part of the chapter. I need to stop you right there, because Biscuit has shown up. And as I've officially decided, the Biscuit is my favorite.
Biscuit's your answer to the discussion question.
100%. And just the bit that I lost it was when Lucy grabs her and, like, she's just all loose, like, skin stretched around hard-boiled eggs of various size, which is so, like, I mean, you know, that's like chocolate chip biscuit dough is sort of the vibe it gives you. It's so fucking gross. I loved it. Like, just imagine carrying around this goblin who's just lumps inside of loose skin. Feral.
Yeah, goblins are always going to be gross, I think.
And her weapon form is like a frisbee.
A plastic frisbee.
I loved it.
Yeah, shitty plastic frisbee. Yeah, I really loved how Lucy beat Angie here. It's like effectively using the small-mindedness of the practitioners that are coming into town against themselves, right? Because they were just like, get the black one. And Lucy's like, all right, well, that's a pretty easy, way to get around this. It's just make Angie look like me. And because, they kind of othered Lucy in that way, and that was enough for it. It was also such a emblematic trick for Lucy as a fey duelist. I loved it. It was so sneaky.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great thing to use against Angie too, because Angie's whole thing is, taking toxic stuff and then lashing back out with it, propagating that sort of cycle. And so Angie's very much like a sort of no-you operator. And so Lucy no-use the no-you operator, which, reverses it right back around to the original.
Yeah.
You're right. It's just so deserved. Lucy talks a lot about karma and fairness, and that seems to be an angle to her practice that she's really leaning into at the moment. And particularly in this chapter, and this is such a good example of it, where she's so incredibly fair with they said go after the black one, so she's like, okay,
yeah, brilliant stuff by Lucy. But yeah, so she's going to escape and helps an opponent by removing a curse from them, and then one of the other practitioners is like, well, we'll still capture you, and then Lucy just fucking throws the curse back at them, and it's so just such a great moment. I really love it.
Yeah, again, it's more of this Lucy is really drawing these lines about what is fair and what is good. It's like she's trying to twist karma into something that's actually kind of fair. She does the right thing here and helps. And then when this lady binds her, she's like, okay, well, if you're saying that it was dumb of me to come here and take this thing and put it in the jar, then you can have it. Which is harsh but fair.
Yeah. Very fair. I mean, explicitly, Lucy's saying, I feel like you're not being fair here. And the lady's like, oh, well, I have a surplus of karma. And Lucy's like, all right, and chucks the curse at her.
It was the same thing with Milo. Milo kept walking around being it's really dumb to not be willing to kill us, blah, blah, blah. It's Lucy gave him the chances or whatever, and he kept saying they were dumb for not going all out. And eventually, you put that sort of pressure on, and she's like, okay, I won't be dumb then. Your rules.
Yeah, it's great. I want to pull out this line as well, where they're talking about Milo, and Lucy says, Milo came at me three different times with murder in mind. He got what he came for. And it's such a baller line, but also I don't know. I feel like Lucy is going to, it's going to really eat at her that she basically committed to having someone else murdered again, similar to what happened with Alexander, right? And I know she knew it going in and all that stuff, but I don't know. It just, it feels a little bit bittersweet, or bitter, but awesome. I don't know if there's a word for that.
See, I must feel a bit differently in that I don't know that this is going to haunt Lucy all that much. Maybe I'll be wrong when things calm down, but I think Lucy's generally sort of grown into this position of I think she means it when she said she tried, he kept coming at her with murder in mind.
I don't think it was an unconsidered or a wrong decision, but I still think she's going to be haunted by the fact that she's had to get people murdered, right?
I don't know. I think she's sort of reached the point where she, I think the thing with Alexander's death is there was all these moments of could we have done it differently, blah, blah, blah. I think she is starting to reach this point where in this conflict they keep attacking them, and she's sort of we've tried to be nice. I think the thing is they were nice for so long. They've gone out of their way not to murder people. She comes, she takes curses off them when she can. She is going out of her way to be nice to people the first one or two times they fight them. And I think I think she might have reached the place where, when she gets Milo killed on the third confrontation or whatever, she can kind of sleep at night because she knows he kind of gave them no choice.
Yeah. I don't know. I think even with the fact that she knows he gave them no choice, I don't think it's going to not weigh on her.
I mean, it doesn't seem to have so far. Like, she's definitely fine with it now, but I guess we'll see after the conflict ends whether that weighs on her. I don't think it should, and I don't know that it will. But yeah.
Mm.
I think we're seeing a Lucy who's really kind of found her lines for this stuff. Like, you know, she's drawn her own karmic framework and is sort of sticking to it. And I think that, like, she's finding a security in that. The universe is agreeing with her.
Mm. Mm.
Now that I say that, I feel like I think Miss told her you could do that in, like, Arc 2, which would be, like, hell of a foreshadowing.
God. So we're getting out of the fight scenes now, but again, just some great action stuff in this chapter.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lucy heads to Verona's domain, but it's guarded by Scott Martin, who she kind of walks up to, and he's like, hey, we're cool. and then she gets into Verona's domain to find Verona just chilling there, very much fine, and there's no problems.
I love this moment with Scott, just because, like, Lucy doesn't even really need to talk him down. Like, she gets there and she's like, hey, I'm Lucy. And he's like, hey, I'm Scott. And she's like, so are we going to sort of do this? And he's pretty much immediately like, listen, my son said you guys were cool. And, like, honestly, fuck dying for Massa. Like, just don't tell them I let you in. And you, like, I think after that previous group where she tried to be kind and fair and they stabbed her in the back, or at least one of them did, it's so nice to then have this moment with the next person just being like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to fight. Like, it really, you know, demonstrates that Lucy is willing to be cool when the other person is.
Yeah. yeah. She's so consistently willing to give people a chance. She's such a hero. Yeah.
I just think it's nice that after dealing with dickheads before this, we do get to also see the moment where, like, her fairness is rewarded in a good way, like, not in a way that she has to dish out a curse back on someone or whatever. It's a, you know, in this way of, yeah, you know, she's fair with this guy, and it pays off because she was fair in the past too.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it's a great way to round out the conflict she's been in so far in this chapter.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I love the reveal afterwards. This happens later, but, like, this Scott Martin guy is actually really powerful and probably could have totally taken Lucy, like, completely.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so great. Like, every time they have made an ally, or Massa has lost an ally, you could think of it as, I suppose, it's just so satisfying. I mean, they're not overtly betraying Massa yet, but, you know, they're,
There are so many like chinks in that armor. Like, it's just,
yes,
yeah. It's so easy to turn some people, or yeah, a group, a significant subgroup of his people against him. In a way, yeah, where they're not willing to overtly betray him, but it's like, oh, if you just want to sneak by, and, you know, I didn't see you, you didn't see me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very fun. It's great.
And I had to, like, this was one of those moments too, when this guy mentioned he had a son, it was like, okay, Martin, straight to the fucking MVP of extra materials, the student guide. It ended up being a bit redundant because Macaulay reminds us later, but this is the father of Salvador, the spider breeding guy.
Yep. Which is very weird. And we get the quote again of, Macaulay explaining the spider breathing, saying, you turn the air spirits in your lungs into spider spirits and blow, or do other stuff, Macaulay explained. Oh, Mal said. Why? It doesn't really get explained, but yeah, very true.
Good question, Mal. I remember us saying the same thing when the extra material came out, because Salvador was down in the extra material as a spider breather.
Mm.
And I feel like the fandom collectively got together and said, why though? And it's the Martin family still has not answered this pressing question.
Yep. yeah, it's will we ever get an explanation, I wonder?
I hope not, honestly. I just think it's funnier unexplained. But yeah, I guess sorry, going back to like Verona here, because as you mentioned, like there's this hilarious juxtaposition where Lucy has just been in the middle of like hectic, bloody shit for this entire chapter so far. And then we get to Verona's, and Verona's just like in her Jimmy Jams having a slumber party. Like Lucy's just kind of seething from the get-go, and you can just see Verona doesn't appreciate it. And I was just like, oh, I can totally understand Lucy's frustration here. She's just been fucking slogging it, and Verona's just here like having a good time.
Yeah, Lucy's frustration is definitely justified here, but also Verona certainly needed this.
There's a lot to unpack. This feels like the second half to the stuff we're talking about with Verona and the family thing, like at the start of the previous chapter, where like once again, I find myself feeling like there's a real mixed bag to this Verona stuff. Because on the one hand, I agree, she really needed this moment to zone out for a bit, connect with Mallory and Macaulay, and just like have a good moment to reinvigorate herself. But I think Lucy is absolutely on the money as well, and is justifiably angry that Verona really dropped the ball communicating with around this. Like Verona kind of says, "Oh, I thought we did communicate about this, like blah blah blah," but I don't think that argument holds up, and I think Lucy tears it down pretty comprehensively.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, this is just that thing with Verona, is what frustrates her is whenever she does manage to find a good thing like this, like she gets this sleepover or whatever, there's always some reason
it's why she not didn't do it the right just way a or good something.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. Like, and so here it's like she kind of fucked up not communicating with Lucy and Avery exactly how it had gone down, and that's meant that Lucy's frustrated with her, and you can just see, and Verona said this is starting to sully this entire experience a bit.
I mean, which is, I don't know, like kind of fair enough, right? I don't feel too bad for Lucy, or you know, like I don't feel like Lucy's out of line here.
No, not at all. And yeah, I guess we'll get to the like the end of it in a bit, but like, yeah, Lucy feels extremely justified. And I like, honestly, in this conversation, I was kind of mostly sitting here waiting for Verona to catch up and realize where exactly she dropped the ball. Cause I get that she needed this, and I don't think it was like the complete wrong thing to do, but it definitely takes Verona a bit to realize that like maybe she did do something a bit wrong here.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. On the other hand, you don't want to be too harsh to Verona on this, because like she did really need it. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but like she was the one just having to go at them for the timing with the parent thing. Like, as Lucy keeps saying to her, they're in the middle of a fucking war. Like, I get that you need this, but you got to step up and communicate better during a war. I also do love that when Macaulay tells Lucy she should have come to the sleepover, Lucy's immediate thought in response is, I wasn't invited. And then she kind of goes into why they shouldn't have been doing the sleepover, which I think she eventually backtracks on a bit. But I just really loved that moment where, yeah, her instinctive response is to note that Verona didn't ask her to join them. And I actually think that that is an important little note here, that Lucy and Verona don't talk about together, but like it's definitely something Lucy has thought about.
I think the most important thing from this section is that Verona confirms that she's A tier by saying that she's way worse in a fight than Lucy or Avery. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, confirmed.
We get textual confirmation that she's the least good practitioner.
She's the lowest tier of the Kenneteers. Yeah. Which is fun.
But yeah, I guess like, yeah, jokes aside, this whole thing with Verona for me is like, so Lucy eventually starts to talk to her and has this sort of moment of like, I think Lucy says to her, I don't want you to pull away. I want you to share stuff with me. And Verona says to her, what if I'm never able to do that? Like, what if it's just how I've been molded in my life? Like, and so I can't like change it back. Like, are you going to get sick of me? And I really love this quote, because this feels like the issue I've been struggling with Verona for quite a while now, is this like feeling that for quite a while now, it hasn't really felt like Verona will have this like come to Jesus moment where she turns around and is like, I'm emotionally vulnerable and communicate good now. Like it just doesn't feel like the end of her story is just like, you know, she's quote unquote fixed, because she's not really, like, to use her own word, broken. So I don't imagine there's going to be this like flipping the switch moment where she just becomes a good communicator and is emotionally vulnerable and shares with everyone. But then at the same time, like, clearly where she is right now isn't working both for her and the people around her. So there's like some weird middle ground, like better coping mechanisms or something that she needs to at least hit some sort of middle ground, where, you know, she's doing better than she is right now, but she doesn't have to become like, you know, Avery 2.0.
She, and I feel like she's going in the right direction, right? Like she's,
yeah,
she's starting to be able to share more with people. It's not Lucy, it's Macaulay and Mal and et cetera. But, you know, she's going in the right direction, right?
Yeah. I mean, I still don't think she's there, because she's got some of these, like, this way she kept trying to silo off parts of her life that kind of backfired with things like Jeremy and Tash is still stuff she's recovering from a bit. But, like, you're right. I think part of the journey with Lucy and Verona is maybe them realizing that that's just not what they are for each other, maybe. I think maybe the other part of it is, with Verona, maybe it's always going to be a bit like drawing teeth. But it's about her being better at putting herself in the position where the people who can like pull those teeth out of her are around. Lucy does a pretty good job of it here and actually gets her to tell her a bit about the like whole Forsworn if we don't make Found Kennet thing.
Kind of.
Yeah. But like, so it's a bit like, you know, even if Verona doesn't become like super open, like someone like Avery or something, it's about like her learning better about why she can talk to some people and not others, and making sure she keeps those people around her or something.
We should talk about, you know, that Lucy and Verona have this sidebar after here, and Lucy's revealing how worried about Verona she is, and Verona kind of lets Lucy know. And yeah, I don't know. It's like, I had this as kind of almost a growth moment for Verona. Like, hard to say.
I almost read it more as a growth moment for Lucy. Like, if we think back to the big fight they had before, I think Lucy does a much better job at communicating with Verona than she did, like, back when they had the big fight about her, like, you know, relationship with Jeremy. I think Lucy does a really good job here of coming at Verona from, like, this place of, like, make it very clear she's not nagging her, she's not, like, you know, she loves her, she values her, and she's not suggesting she's weak. She's just like, I can tell that you're nettled, and you should be. We're in the middle of a war, so, like, what is happening? And I think Lucy communicates better with Verona than she did back in the day. So this is sort of what I'm talking about with Verona. Maybe Verona doesn't get quote-unquote fixed, but she just gets better at teaching people how to talk to her, or keeping people like Lucy who can around, or Macaulay, or whoever she's comfortable with.
I don't know. She'll get there. She'll get there. I have faith. But will it be before the end of the story? Who knows? The trio patch in Zed, who gives them the advice that they should set up 3 ritual sites and then scuttle the ones they don't want to use. And so they gather the council to kind of plan their moves here. Rook reveals that she's been dealing with Edith.
I guess to go back to Zed, the first bit you mentioned there, I love how he's just such a keen bean to help out. Like, because they call him and they're a bit like, hey, Zed, like, we're so sorry. We know we just keep asking you for stuff and never giving you anything. And he has to be like, I don't think you understand. Like, you're asking me to talk about my obsession. Like, this is fine.
Yeah. Of course, he loves to chat about nerdy shit. That's Zed's whole vibe.
Yeah, like, this is literally, like, his, you know, thing that he's obsessed with. Like,
yeah,
of course he wants to tell you all about how it works and help you set stuff up for it. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about this deal. Rook has given her vote to Edith until she betrays Kennet, which is a little bit vague. We don't know if that means, like, if Edith moves against the rest of the council or if Edith like betrays Liz. Like, we don't, it's a wide scope of things there. So, you know, could be anything.
Yeah, it's very open to interpretation, which, you know, we know Rook likes to focus on positioning, and it feels like being in a good position, having a very open-ended oath like that. I guess, like, what really stands out to me here is, like, as we've said ad nauseum in this arc, recently the story has been asking us to question a lot, like, who we work with and, like, how you can build something good if you work with people with bad pasts. And I feel like Rook fails that test in this chapter, essentially, because Rook makes the case, oh, I've seen so many war councils in times like this fail because, you know, they fell due to infighting. And so it doesn't matter what Edith did to us. Like, it doesn't matter what Charles and stuff have done. If they're on our side, we need to work with them in this time of war. And I'm like, I totally get what she's saying, but also this, like, it goes so much against what all the discussions around building Found Kennet were, where it's like, how do we make sure we do this right? Whereas, like, Rook just wants to get it done. And, I mean, Guillaume steps up to kind of call her out on this a bit. But I think it's really interesting that it's been a big theme recently in the story. Like, you know, make sure you pick the good team that you're with. And Rook kind of fails that and does the very Musa side thing of just siding with whoever to get the job done.
Mm. Yeah, it's I don't know, pretty shitty. It's definitely pretty shitty. It's, but then again, it is Rook's whole deal, right? So yeah.
Well, and it's like her logic isn't totally flawed, like the logic of, hey, Edith and Charles want to fight with us against Musa, and, you know, we need them. Like, she's not wrong.
Yeah.
And, like, Edith is a member of the council because they made that deal with Liss. So, like, she's not wrong. She's just falling into, like, a bad trap, it is what it feels like. And, you know, it's just, like, even Guillaume calls her out. I think Guillaume has this moment where it says, I hope it doesn't take you another 100 incidences to find a third way forward after it took you 100 to find your second.
Mm.
Which is just, like, such a sick burn coming from a winter fairy that you're too slow to adapt. And this is what it comes down to me, is like, it just feels like Rook is falling into these same traps that she has 100 times in the past.
Mm. Yeah. No, I think so too. I don't know. Is she sacrificing the moral victory for the victory, or is she just sacrificing the moral victory for no benefit? Who knows? You know, we'll have to see.
Yeah, it'll depend what the deals are, which she won't fucking tell us. But the argument, like, here, like, they lost in Arc 13 because Lucy wouldn't cut any of these corners. So it's like, it's not that the arguments for her way aren't there. It's just, yes, you know, losing the war to win the battle kind of potential vibes.
Yeah. Rook also says here that she's dealt with Charles, but she doesn't really explain what she means by that.
Hmm.
Who knows what that means? And it would be nice to know, because that might give us some, some of an idea about what the fuck Charles is actually doing. But I guess we'll get that eventually.
Especially she also says that she now understands Marissica's part in all this, and I'm like, you can't just say that and then not elaborate for us. Like, Marissica has been such an enigma since the end of Arc 13. Like, she seems really strung out, but then, you know, she's a fairy, so how much is this, like, you know, she's still cooking up schemes on the side? Mm. Like, I'm almost more interested to learn what Marissica's been up to these past few weeks than Charles. Charles has just been sitting on his ass waiting for his moment to enact his plan, is how it feels to me, whereas I feel like Marissica's the one who's been up to the really weird shit as she travels around.
Yeah. It's just, again, a complete mystery to us, but hopefully we'll get some more clues soon, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then we end with this, with Rook being like, I think I know what rules Miss is going to impose, and some of us already have a head start, but let's be prepared, which
is implying masks, right? Like,
I mean, I didn't get that at all, but I love it as an idea.
It's got to be masks, because that's what the Some of Us Already Have a Head Start implies to me. Like, Rook and the Kenneteers are very much mask-wearing folks. So, you know, let's everyone get a mask.
I mean, she says that as she's standing next to, like, Edith, Reggie, and the Turtle Queen, which implied to me that Edith, Reggie, and the Turtle Queen were the ones who had the head start.
I don't know about that. That's just her kind of... I think that's just there to show us. Rook's building her own little army, basically.
Seeing Edith behind Rook next to the Turtle Queen, I'm just back on my, like, bias against the Turtle Queen train, where I'm like, fuck,
100%.
So much, like, I've been actively forcing myself not to distrust the Turtle Queen for, like, weeks at this point. And then now that we're kind of getting this rhetoric from Rook and seeing Edith stand behind her too, I'm just like, oh no, I'm back to the Turtle Queen's a problem.
Yeah, Turtle Queen's definitely a problem. 100% sure, yeah. Turtle Queen's a problem.
But no, I hadn't thought of this mask thing. I really like it. I hope you're right, because getting masks for everyone would be great.
Mm.
Did we ever find out, sorry, this is an aside, did we ever find out what the maggot, lion, and crane masks were about from Verona's Domain ritual?
Yes, we did. Those are the masks that the Kenneteers' parents are going to wear once they awaken.
Okay, yeah. That's which one's for rats?
The maggot.
Okay. He's not a fierce lion?
I said that because that's one of the things that I've seen in the Discord, I believe. But okay. No, we didn't actually find out. But I think that's a pretty good lead.
If it's a male lion, don't the male lions mostly just sit around all day and have everyone else do things for them? If it's a lion's head, could be brave. He's just loud and obnoxious and makes everyone else do shit for him.
Other option is if found Kennet has a masks, you know, a mask mandate, let's call it, then the conspirators will need masks as well. So we could see a Charles, Edith,
I think that was the first, thing I tried to play with and I couldn't come up with anything. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway, sorry. Yeah. I think that's the end of it. So yeah, what a great chapter. I'm loving seeing Lucy really grow into this person who's like becoming a lot more steadfast in what she thinks is fair and unfair, and like the universe is starting to move with her. Is really, that was like my big takeaway from this chapter, is Lucy's really bringing karma into all her fights in a really cool way.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. She's all about that justice.
And yeah, I suppose it's a little bit more violent than I'd like, but as she pointed out, they started it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the first rule of karma since the moment we're born. We all understand the real villain is the one who started it.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the end of these chapters for this week. But before we wrap up the show, we are going to pull out some power predictions. Predictions from the community that have been left in our power predictor sheet form. If you want to leave a prediction yourself, you can find the link to do that in the show notes down below. But yeah, let's get into some, we're in ripe prediction territory now, because who knows what the fuck's going to happen in this story.
Yep.
Do you want to pull out your prediction first, Elliot?
Yeah, sure. I've got a prediction from Three Moose, which is moose. What's the plural of moose? Is it meeses?
Mice, I think.
Mice. Okay. So three mice too. Basically, and this is it was a very long prediction. I've really trimmed it down. But essentially, Three Moose is predicting that Charles's plan is to drop like another sort of red heron inveiglement down on Kennet as Muster's lordship claim wraps up. So specifically to fuck over the practitioners. So a ritual that kind of requires you to lie or fucks with your word. Just so that's basically the plan that he's waiting to drop at the last minute, is he wants all of the practitioners to gather here. So he's waiting for Musa and Grayson and shit to arrive to drop another Hungry Choir-esque ritual on everyone.
Mm.
And they cite a bunch of like reasons why they think this is the case, like that the Hungry Choir may not fully be gone. Charles was actually a bit iffy in how he worded that he'd got rid of the Hungry Choir.
Mm.
And obviously we know that this is... like, this is his MO. He's literally done this before.
He
created rituals like this. it's a nice extension of his actions in terms of like gainsaying the practitioners. Like that's laying groundwork for this ritual to exist where it weakens someone's word because he's been intentionally fucking with that part of the system.
And
as well as creating new others, his current role as the Carmine is to decide what others naturally spring up, so which is kind of just an extra tool now in his toolkit to create his perfect like ritual.
I really like this one. I think this definitely makes a lot of sense to me and would explain if Charles's plan is effectively drop something big on Kennet. I mean, he's waiting for the right time.
This is a good
right?
answer for what that
and
is.
And it's going to mean, it's going to be, you know, the Kendricks have just dealt with the three things that they were planning and then suddenly, oh shit, there's a fourth thing.
Yeah. So I the more I read this theory, the more I was like, this feels like a lot of bits in the story clicking into place in a cool way. So I would not be surprised if this is kind of pretty close to the money.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like it. For mine, I've put out a prediction from I'm Measly Impressed, which is a much zanier prediction than your one, which is that Scott Martin is secretly actually Zachariah Nichols' dad. And when he said, "You were good to my boy," he didn't mean, what's his name?
Salvador.
Salvador, yeah. He meant Zachariah Nichols.
Yeah, I low-key love this prediction. I know, it's so obviously good. It's a lot less like serious and directly applicable than the previous one, but like feels like even more on the money. Like I read this and I was like, I'm almost just willing to headcanon it.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing I love about this prediction is like there's a 0% chance this is ever going to come into the story.
But
I just like I love it. Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the pieces of evidence that I'm Easily Impressed pulls out is that Sal's family was paying for Zachariah's tuition, which I don't remember, but assuming that's true, like that's a big thing that I really like love that the answer is because Zach was not from any important family. Actually, he's secretly Scott Martin's son. And that's why they were paying for his tuition. Like,
oh, it's that's why his dad is like drama. So obsessed with them being friends and stuff.
Because I
vaguely remember Salvador saying that his dad wanted him to walk out for Zachariah at the school.
Yeah, like,
so, yeah, I was
just such a great, it's so good, it's so fucking juicy. And like, I don't know if it's ever going to come into it, but it's just awesome.
Yeah, I can't, even if it did, like, even if this got confirmed, I can't imagine it mattering, like, because they're such not even tertiary, quaternary, like, characters. It's just, like, a neat bit of world building that, like, yeah, there was some infidelity going on in these, like, third-tier practitioner families.
Yeah, exactly. It's wonderful. A great prediction. Loved it. But that's the end of our show. For this week. As a reminder, everyone, we are currently running a discussion question, which is which goblin is best and why? And if you want to leave your answer to that discussion question, you can leave it in our discussion thread, which will be linked in the show notes down below.
I don't think we have many answers to that one yet as well. So not many people have seen the light and realized the answer is Biscuit.
Sure. We can leave you all to argue that out in the discussion thread.
Yeah, at me if you don't think it's Biscuit because you're wrong, and I'll fight you. Fight you IRL.
Yeah, perfect. as a reminder, we've got our fan art contest going on at the moment, so make sure you get your submissions in by the 1st of April. So you've got about 10 days. Get that in to us. You can find more info on the website, doofmedia.com.
Yes. Don't forget our Twitter as well. We post memes there. We also get memes posted at us. In fact, recently we've been getting people taking the memes we posted, tweaking them and making them better, and then sending them back to us, which is hilarious, like but also rude.
Yeah. Well, you need to, it's pretty good.
people need to post memes at us, but not funnier than the ones we do. Like I just want you in the middle there. I'm kidding. Like, yeah, the some of the remixes we got for that, Soot Sleeves meme this week were great.
Yeah, definitely.
Send us your memes as well as enjoying ours.
Yeah, we've had some good ones lately. Some bad ones too, but you know, it's a mixed bag. Hey, wait a second. Elliot, the one that I had scheduled that was going to go out, I think today, did you reschedule it?
It was so gross. And now it's back.
Oh, yeah. No, I had to push that one because there was another time-sensitive one going out today.
Tragic. Well, that's coming out in about a week, so never mind. I was about to say, go check it out because I think it would have just posted either today or yesterday. But instead, now you got to wait for it because it's fucking disgusting and hilarious. anyway, that's the end of our show, folks. If you want more...
We haven't done the part about doofmedia.com.
Yeah, no, I was getting to that. Okay. If you want more from the Doof Network, you want to check out more of the shows on the network, you can go to doofmedia.com. There's all kinds of great shows on there. As well as you can get access to all kinds of extra bits and pieces if you're one of our special secret club. Now, the way to join that secret club is a secret. So lean in close. You have to go to patreon.com/doofmedia and become a patron there, and you'll become one of our secret club members.
I didn't sign up for this ASMR nonsense.
sorry, that's my other show, the Otherverse ASMR show.
Don't forget to stop by Patreon's Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo. Obviously, he's been writing this story, and none of us would be here without him. So please donate what you can.
Yeah. And with that, we'll see you next time.